and welcome to Pitigwe. Come in. This is a space where stories live, breathe, and connect us. Here we honor the voices of our Métis people, gathering wisdom from the past, celebrating resilience in the present, and shaping a path for the future. Each episode is a thread in the sash, weaving together tales of culture, tradition, and community. So come in, sit with us, and let's share stories that remind us who we are and where we belong. This is Pitigwe. This is home. Okay, we're back here, day one of the Métis Nation Saskatchewan Legislative Assembly. And with me this afternoon, I have...
My name is Jerry Gardner.
Jerry Gardner. Where are you from, Jerry?
I'm from Isle of La Crosse Lake. That's where I'm from originally.
Okay.
I was raised there when I was not in the residential school. My parents and my grandfather, great-grandfather. My great-grandfather is descendant of the Red River.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know exactly the year that he made his way to Isle of Crosse, but it was probably in the late 1800s.
And what was your great-grandfather's name?
His name was Robbie Gardner. He was a Scottish half-breed from Red River. Yeah. And he was an educated man. He probably the first school teacher in Isle of La Crosse.
Oh, nice.
Is what I've heard, yeah.
And be here today.
Sometimes he's not represented at the Rosignol School or the school in Isle of La Crosse. I'm not sure why. Maybe people don't know. I don't know. But he was educated. But we always thought funny that he never... Yes. He never allowed his kids to be educated.
Okay.
His children, like my grandfather, they weren't educated in the, regular education.
Oh, okay.
They didn't speak English.
And what did they speak?
They spoke mostly Cree and Michif. That's the language they spoke.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So before we came on air, Jerry, you told me that you were raised on Isle of La Crosse Lake, not in the village. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, we were raised in along the mouth of the Beaver River and also Sandy Point and up the lake. The lake is about 50, 60 miles long, and we were raised on the north end of the lake, right along the lake anywhere. We were just probably nomadic at the time. As a child, I remember, and depended on which season. Like if it was fall, we'd move into the bush for trapping, winter trapping, getting ready for winter trapping and stuff, and hunting, moose hunting, and preparing for the winter time.
Can you share with me some of the earliest memories of living that nomadic life?
I was very young, probably, 3, 4, 5 years old, just before I went into residential school. And we were all in residential school. I was 6 years old when I went into residential school in Isle of La Crosse.
Okay.
Yeah. And then my younger siblings followed. And pretty soon my parents... I guess they didn't like their children being in the residential school by themselves. Had to kind of forced to move to Isle of Crosse, to the village of Isle of Crosse. But I was already out of school back then. So,
how old would you have been back then?
I probably was around maybe about 15 or something, 16 years old. Yeah. I didn't go to school anymore. I just quit. I forget what grade it was, but I took off and left up north. I worked the summer and had enough money to charter an aircraft, a float plane, and it took me north to a place called Moose Nose Mountain Lake.
Whereabouts is that?
That's straight, probably northeast of Isle of La Crosse, about 50 miles. along the Churchill River. So that's when that's where I spent almost 20 winters trapping.
A trapper, okay. And what animals did you trap, Jerry?
Probably a lot of foxes back then, and minks, fishers, and then there was a period of about 3-4 years later on that the lynx were, you know, average 8 to 1200 bucks a piece.
Wow.
So if you pulled out 30 lynx as a young man, it was good. And at the same time, it was not good because, you know, as a young man, when you come back to town, then you do quite a bit of drinking there.
Oh, okay.
And all that, the stuff that young people do, but... I don't know if you ever did that. You looked like you were a saint, but...
Oh, no, far from it, Jerry, far from it. What was life like being a trapper?
Oh, that was... I never forget it to this day. It was the best part of my life. The feeling of freedom and, you know, nobody ever bothered you. Because where we were, where I was, there was no sign of other humans. I was by myself. It was isolated, no roads, nothing. The only access, well, besides walking, would be an airplane and a snowmobile in late winter time. And we eventually made a trail for a snowmobile, and that's what we used. And then later on in life, I had a few dogs. I used dogs for traveling. Yeah.
And where did you... learn how to trap, Jerry?
Well, we learned how to trap ever since we started to walk when we were kids. Yeah, our dad, that's where our dad lived, so we knew how to do it. It came natural to trap and to learn the forest, you know, to learn where the animals walked and where the animals, certain animals were. Because it's certain seasons where you get different types of animals. Like the lynx wouldn't get prime until maybe December. You know, fully primed. You get them earlier, but the beginning of December, the end of November, they'd be fully primed, depending on the weather. And the foxes would be earlier.
What do you mean by primed?
I don't suppose it's plumed, but, you know, like a bird. They have the under fur and the guard hairs, you know. They're fully furred. I don't know how else to explain it.
Okay. Can you elaborate a little bit on the guard hairs and the other hairs?
Yeah. As it gets colder, the fur starts getting more
thicker.
Thicker and yeah. But then again, it didn't stay very long that way because. Once you get into January, then they start what they call a rub. They start rubbing, like you get a warm day where the snow melts and they lay down. Their fur, especially the guard fur, would stick, freeze onto the snow. And when they got up, they pull it out. Eh? So eventually their fur wasn't that good.
Really?
Yeah. So it's just the under fur that they had, but that guard fur were gone, especially around the sides. So as the season days got longer, you know, the quality of fur was downgraded to. So we stopped trapping when that happened. So days like melting days in January was not good for trapping, or any day in. Like in wintertime when you're trapping, it's not good for the fur, especially foxes also.
Okay.
They rub really fast, eh? It's called a rub.
And you said it wasn't good because the quality of furs went down?
Yeah, well, you can see it when you go sell them. The fur buyer recognizes them right away, so you don't get as much or hardly anything, depending on how much they're damaged.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So when you were in the prime of your trapping career... Where would you take the furs to go and sell them?
Sometimes we shipped them to fur auctions, but most of the time we sold them to.
Once again, the auditor has presented us with.
You know, we had a lot of fur buyers back then, huh? People would, there'd be the Hudson Bay stores and LaRange had quite a few fur buying stations. We kind of knew where the best price was.
Yeah.
And then we knew the quality of the fur too. So the poor quality fur, we went and took them to the people that didn't really recognize the fur, so we kind of sold it to them. But the good quality fur, we took them to the guys that knew the fur.
Oh, okay.
So we got top price for it, yeah.
So you'd try to get the top price at both places.
We knew what we were doing, yeah.
So when did trapping start to decline?
Oh, geez, probably in the 80s. In the 80s, it was good. It was really good, the 80s. And then 90s, probably 90s. You know, the ending of the 90s, it started to decline. There was a very low demand on fur for one reason or another, so it wasn't. Started to decline and started, and it was expensive to go trapping because gasoline and all that. So it wasn't quite worth it that way financially. Yeah, but in a matter of healthy living, it was good because we lived off the land and
and
80-90% of our food was from the land.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And what did you transition into after your trapping life?
Well, after I got married and had kids, and I realized I needed a job to supplement my trapping. I did quite a bit of commercial fishing also during the summer back then. So there's a lot of commercial fishing.
Okay.
And then I started working for the government about maybe a little over 30 years ago as wildfire management. Firefighter.
Oh, okay. And how long did you do that?
A little over 30 years. I'm supposed to be retired this year, right? Like right now. I'm still putting it off, but I will be retiring now pretty quick.
Oh, okay.
Pretty quick here.
Congratulations.
It's an institution where it's hard to get out of, you know? Yeah.
So what's more in your blood, wildfire management or trapping?
It's all land. It's all related to land, so I love both all of them. Anything that's related to land. I've always been a land person. So I travel the land, from the land, and I travel the air also. I do a lot of flying with the helicopters and other aircraft, fire detection aircraft. Yeah.
And so in the fire business, what was your role there? What did you do?
Well, in the beginning, I was just like a crew member. I was just, you know, the regular crew member. Then I transitioned into, not very long, into a crew boss. I was a boss of because of the fact that I knew the land. So it was easy for me to go into it. And then the past 10, 15 years as fire supervisor.
Oh, okay.
So all I did was coordinate fires, mostly in the air, and coordinated fires. I placed people in strategic areas where, you know. So there's a lot of things, like you got to know the weather forecast and all that stuff, and the winds for sure. You have to know all that. And I knew that naturally. Living on the land, you know the weather, and you have a good idea what it's going to be like next tomorrow. But with the firefighter management, have weather, you know, we got our own meteorologist, so we know just about know what kind of day or what kind of wind's going to be. So you got to know all that stuff.
So that nomadic bush life was in your favor when it came firefighting.
It was easy to get into, into that life.
And so, were you married?
I was married, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was your wife's name?
Her name was Rita. Yeah.
How many children did you and Rita have?
Just like my dad. He was asked how many children he had. Oh, about 5 or 6. But anyway, I had 3 biologically, and yeah. I kind of raised 2.
Oh, okay.
3 maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, kids that came into the house, I kind of raised them. Yeah.
Yeah. Where are your children now?
Well, they're all grown. They're all grown now.
Okay.
Yeah. They're some are now across, some are different places across
oh,
country.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Grandchildren?
Yeah. Yeah. Don't ask me how many.
Okay. I won't ask how many.
Yeah. I do have 2 great grandchildren. So they're, yeah.
A proud grandfather. Good for you.
Yeah.
Have you passed on any of your land skills to your grandchildren and your children?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. They learn naturally. Natural. Yeah. They learn basic survival skills. They're pretty good. Yeah.
And how does it make you feel to take your grandchildren out on the land and teach them?
It feels good. Feels good, yeah. It feels good. But throughout the years, I've noticed the land itself has been, you know, they talk about climate change, and I do a lot of record keeping, and you know, and there is quite a big change on the landscape. For instance, a lot of birds are missing. A lot of birds that were there when I was a kid is no longer there. Like, you know, insects, you notice there's starting to be a lot of insects, like, for example, spiders, because they don't have as much predators as they used to.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of insects all over. And the shorelines are kind of quiet. They used to be full of life along the shorelines of the lakes. You know, the what they call the riparian zones. They used to be full of life.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of creatures, little creatures missing. The frogs disappeared. No frogs.
And
since this past summer, I've been hired by Métis Land Guardians, so I'm doing that now quite a bit.
Nice, good.
Last time.
And why? What? Why are the animals disappearing?
I think a lot of it where we are is there's fallout from the tar sands of Alberta. We're right on the prevailing winds. You see this soot on the lakes in the springtime when the snow is melting, the ice is melting. You see the soot out in the lake. So the snow melts very fast. And to my understanding, I don't know, I'm not a biologist, but it's acid. So the frogs are very sensitive. They feel the stuff, eh? The first, so they disappeared. Yeah. So there's a lot of birds missing, a lot of animals missing. They're no longer there.
So when some of those animals are missing, what happens to the other animals?
Well, like I said, there is a chain reaction. Like, insects don't have as much predators, and there's more insects. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Before we close, Jerry, if you had a message for the next generation, what would that message be?
learn a language and know who you are. Your language. Because we do have our own unique language system in the northwestern part of the Michif language. But we're also fluent in Cree. One side of my parents were Michif, and one side of my parents was Cree, Woodland Cree. So I know both. I'm fluent in both. The Michif we talk is a lot of old French mixed in with Woodland Cree words. I notice down here, it's kind of mixed in with maybe, I don't know, I'm guessing it's Ojibwe, and they have an accent sort of thing. So, but the words are similar. The old words, you know, I talked to Norman Fleury, and I could understand them. Because I heard my grandmother use these words when I was a child, you know. But, you know, the verbs that they use in between the, you know, are different. Yeah, maybe it's some sort of Cree, but pronounced differently. Yeah, but it's still understood. I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we do have our own unique language that we speak.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you for your time, Jerry, and coming to share a bit of time with me here. Looking forward to anything for the rest of the weekend?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, I never was involved in that, the political part of it. Any Métis movement or anything with politics. I never was. Just recently, I had an interest in, I don't know. I can't say I like it yet, but I'm here. Yeah, I'm here because I care that it could help in the long run, land wise, and our survival as a people.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, Jerry, I'd like to thank you again for sharing some time with me, and look forward to seeing you on the trail in the future.
Nice talking to you.